The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
There is no day in the Jewish calendar that is more challenging in terms of what we're meant to feel and what state of mind we're attempting to achieve than Yom Kippur. And it gets a little confusing. It's not an easy day. I had a soldier. It's one of those experiences where you look back and you don't wonder, you know that there were all sorts of things that you could have and should have done and you just weren't there yet. His name was Shai Tzinder. He was a soldier in the unit that I had last towards the end of my army experience and the regular army. And you know, there's a big struggle today. Guys who feel that the Jewish people survived for 2,000 years because Jews were learning Torah, and to get up and leave the yeshiva and go to the army wears you down. It's not so simple after all that work. It's not so simple. And much as you can guess that I have my issues with that approach, you have to respect where that's coming from. Because the truth is, the army does wear you down. And any Jew that feels that he's learning and he's involved in mitzvot and to go to the Israeli army is going to challenge him spiritually, religiously, that's a legitimate perspective. I have my issues with that. You can guess I have a different approach. I believe it's a mechamet mitzvah, it's a war of a mitzvah. We don't have the option not to do it, but I understand it. And this particular soldier, this boy, was an example of that type of challenge. He came from a religious kibbutz, whatever that means, and I watched the army erode him. After a while, he stopped coming in the morning to the synagogue to daven. Eventually, the guys would, you know, get together and maybe on the way stop for a pitot that weren't necessarily kosher. And he might not eat pork, but, you know, he'd have the pitot. He didn't check whether it was kosher. And eventually, he would kind of be in the room. They had a television donated on the base that we were in for like 3 months when we were in a normal base. And the guys would all, you know, most of the guys in my unit, this was the only other guy with a kippah. So, you know, they would watch wrestling Shabbos afternoon. They were having a different approach to Yaakov's struggle with the angel. And he would sort of eventually, he started wandering in, and eventually he would sit, and eventually he was watching the wrestling. And you just watched gradually, he was eroding. I wasn't in the state, in the frame of mind that I'm in now. You know, I wasn't running Israelite. I was in the army unit. So, you know, he's a good soldier. And one day he came to me, he wanted to talk to me. He said, the guys used to give him a really hard time because he still wore his kippah. And he said, like, I don't call myself really religious anymore. And don't get me wrong, how you define religious, that anybody can call himself secular if he's wearing an Israeli army uniform and standing on the border is absurd. But this is the way he defined himself. I don't consider myself religious. But you know, I know that if I go home and I visit my family and my parents and they see me without a kippah, it'll really be hard for them. And the thought of going there with a kippah and then coming back to the army and taking it off, it seems to me so deceptive, so hypocritical, I can't bear to do it. You know? And I'm struggling with this. And the guys are all making fun of me. Because they're saying, you know, tachlit, make up your mind. Atadati or talodati. Are you religious or not religious? If you're religious, what are you doing here with us watching wrestling? You should go to the show. Keep any company. And if you're not religious, take it off. And be true to who we are. What is this nonsense? It's a little bit of a ridiculous discussion, but okay. So he wanted to know what I thought, and the way he phrased the question to me, it only hit me much later, what he was really asking. He said to me, I don't know if God exists, and I don't know what God thinks about what I'm doing. And my question is, do you think that I should take my kippah off? What does God think? It's an interesting question. First of all, I wasn't sure what frame of reference he was coming from. He wasn't coming to me as a rabbi. I wasn't a rabbi yet. I was an officer. And if he was so concerned with what God was thinking, what about the rest of Judaism and Shabbat and Kashrut? So it was an interesting question, because it was a very Jewish question, but it wasn't really a fully Jewish question. I didn't know what to say. Very difficult question. This is a question way beyond halacha, way beyond Jewish tradition, because technically a kippah is not even halacha, it's a custom. It's a custom that's so strong that the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, says it's minhag halacha, it's become halacha. And a Jew should wear it. But if you came from a community where they never adopted the tradition, you might not have an obligation to wear it. So it's a challenging custom. But I understood that this was much less about what he was doing and more about what he was feeling. And the only thing I could think of to say was, look, I can't tell you whether you should wear a kippah or not. I can tell you that if you take it off, it'll be much more difficult to put it back on. And he decided not to take it off. I was discharged from the army a week later. It was like my last week in the army. The night that I finished my regular army service, I got home, and my parents, my unit had just redeployed in the Jordan Valley the day before I got out. I'd helped with the redeployment, but I hadn't done what I normally do because I knew I was getting out of the army, so there was no point in my learning the line, whatever. And they were going off to patrol. The Jordan Valley at the time was one of the quietest borders. Nothing ever happened in Jordan Valley. The night I got home, I was watching the news, and there was a Jordanian soldier, terrorist, from the Jordanian army, who snuck across the border, a fanatic, opened fire on an Israeli patrol, my unit, that patrol, and Shai Tzinder and Rafi, whatever, a sergeant in the unit, were killed. So the next day I went to his funeral. And I sat at the Shiva with the parents. And I debated and decided to tell them the story. And I told them, you know, I want you to know, your son was struggling with religion, but his love for you was an incredibly overpowering thing. You must have given him a lot. And I talked to him about him as a soldier. And you can imagine, forever I'll wonder what I could have done in that week with Shai Tzinder. And I think that there was a part of his question that was very much about judgment. What am I doing? Am I going to pay a price for this? Is God watching me? Am I doing something wrong? And it seems that we're entering a period where these are the issues that we're struggling with. What are we trying to achieve? Rosh Hashanah, Yom HaDin, a day of reckoning. Yom Kippur. There's a Talmudic discussion on the 32nd folio in Rosh Hashanah, and the angels come to God, and they ask God, why aren't we saying Hallel? Hallel are the psalms of praise, of thanksgiving. Why aren't we saying Hallel on Yom Kippur? It's a festival. And so there's an Amora, there's a Talmudic scholar by the name of Rav Krus Pedai. Strange name, cruel parents. Rav Krus Pedai says, Malachim Sharim. Can the angels sing when the books of life and death are open before me? Sfarim Ptuchim Lefanai. Yom Kippur is the day when the books are still open. And if you look at the prayers, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, one of the most powerful prayers, Mi Yichye U'Mi Yamut, it's the creed on Rosh Hashanah, who will live and who will die. Who will die? Mi Varash, from the earthquake. U'Mi Vamagefa, who from the plague. Mi Yanua, all of these different possibilities. And so you're in the midst of a period when the rest of the year is somehow being determined, whatever that means. That's a very heavy day. That's a day, maybe, of sadness, solemnity. I'm supposed to take it seriously. And if you look at some of the sources for what Yom Kippur is about, it would seem that this is a day that I'm supposed to suffer. I mean, let me ask you an honest question, okay? This is a rhetorical question. I would be willing to bet. How many people here really get excited about Yom Kippur? Yom Kippur's coming. We're going to get to fast. I love it. It's a big diet day. We don't wear comfortable shoes. There's a number of other things that we don't do on Yom Kippur. We're going to get to be in synagogue all day. Great! And these things, they're actually five things that we don't do on Yom Kippur. They're called the Chamesh Inuyim, the five afflictions. We don't wear comfortable shoes, ni'ilata sandal. You're not supposed to go, I mean, technically, the Talmud describes it as leather shoes, but there's a discussion in the Talmud that that Rav used to wear shoes that were so thin that he could feel the pebbles beneath his feet. It was uncomfortable. You know, we kind of get all decked up and wear the sneakers, Nike Air Super, but no leather sneakers. And don't get me wrong, just to be clear, technically, that's allowed. There's nothing wrong with that. Don't, God forbid, walk into a synagogue and think, I was an Israelite, I know you're all sinners, like, God forbid. But we're missing something. You're supposed to be a little bit uncomfortable. We don't anoint ourselves with fragrances and oils. We don't bathe, rechitza. You don't go swimming Yom Kippur afternoon, you don't take a shower on Yom Kippur. And again, as with all things Israelite, I'm sharing with you about the day. What you do on your own is always up to you. You shouldn't feel tashmish amita, relations with your wife, you don't have on Yom Kippur. Despite the fact that we were talking, some of us before, about how that is one of the greatest potentials for developing a relationship with God, for becoming a partner in creation, not on Yom Kippur. Because Yom Kippur is about suffering, right? Hopefully that wouldn't be about suffering, depends on your relationship. And then of course, achila v'shtiyah, eating and drinking. You fast. And this is based on the verse, which is in Parshat Emor, right? It's in Vayikra. And what does the verse say? B'chodesh ha-shvi'i, on the seventh month, be'asor l'chodesh, on the tenth day, Yom Kippur, te'anu et nafshotechem. You shall afflict your souls. It's not just to be afflicted. I want it to go to your soul. I want you to be afflicted. It doesn't exactly engender a wonderful relationship with God. I love you, and I know that you want me to afflict myself for you. It seems like such a non-Jewish idea. I remember when Ayatollah Khomeini died. It was a tremendously sad day, you can imagine. But okay, you're not supposed to be happy when your enemy dies. Ayatollah Khomeini died. And I was in awe, okay? Because hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Iranians went out for the funeral. Now you could argue they have no cable television, they have nothing else to do, but hundreds of thousands of people. And they showed pictures on the news of you know, within certain sectors of Islamic society. So mourning, a sign of mourning is to flagellate yourself. The Bible, actually, the Torah talks about that within Judaism you're not allowed to do this. And it talks about the fact that you're not supposed to cut yourself. And the commentaries say that one of the Canaanite practices, the pagans, as a sign of mourning, of pain, would cut their bodies. And the idea is that paganism is the worship of nature, and therefore I'm attacking nature in my pain, because my joy is all about the beauty of nature. And I never really fully understood this until I saw these images. And they're beating themselves, and cutting themselves, and bleeding. It was unbelievable to me. And it's such a non-Jewish image. And comes along the Torah and says, on the 10th day, on Yom Kippur, V'initem et nafshotechem, and you shall afflict your souls. And the essence of Yom Kippur seems to be the Chamesh Inuyim, the five afflictions. In fact, I want you to know, I remember when my wife was pregnant with Mayan, she was already at a stage of pregnancy where, you know, Baruch Hashem, we were considering the question, what should she do on Yom Kippur? And Halacha says, unless of course she's in danger, that's a different discussion, but in a normal pregnancy, that a woman is capable of fasting. Now, just so nobody walks away with the wrong impression, the Halacha, Jewish tradition in these areas is fascinating. If you go to a rabbi, and the rabbi says, I want you to know the Halacha, you have to fast on Yom Kippur. And you go to a doctor, and the doctor says, listen, I don't care what the rabbi says, I'm telling you, it's threatening a life. The life of the mother is in danger, or the baby, whatever. You have to listen to the doctor. Halacha. And if, in fact, you go to the doctor, and the doctor says, don't worry about it. No life-threatening. But you go to the rabbi says, I don't care what the doctor says, I think it's life-threatening, don't do it. You have to listen to the rabbi. And the best part of this halacha, and this is not just some nice Hasidic, this is in the code of Jewish law, it's in Shulchan Aruch. It's in the laws of Shabbat, because it's speaking about whether you desecrate Shabbat, which is one of the most significant things you might desecrate. If the rabbi says, there's no threat to life, and the doctor says, there's no threat to life, and your best friend says, I'm telling you, this is dangerous, don't do it, you listen to your friend. It's amazing. If somebody thinks a life is in danger, then the life is in danger. Because a doubt, and even a doubt about a doubt, what's called sveik sveika, you don't take a risk. But generally everybody agrees that when a woman is pregnant, you're not threatening any life. But you don't want to get into a situation where she starts to have contractions. So Halacha says that if the choice is between going to synagogue, praying all day, being involved in the ritual of the day, or staying at home, lying in bed in the cool air conditioning, so that you won't have to risk breaking your fast, you're better off spending Yom Kippur at home, in bed, than going to synagogue, having a meaningful, moving, spiritual experience, if it means you have to break your fast. Which seems to imply that a fast is a pretty important part of the day. Which would make a lot of sense to me, if the whole point of Yom Kippur is somehow to afflict my soul. Now, I don't know about you. I don't get high on getting afflicted. It's not really my speed. And I find it very difficult to relate to a God who wants me to afflict myself. So what's up with that? What is this about? What is Yom Kippur? And by the way, if you look within the framework of Halacha, you find many, many instances in the words of the rabbis. The Zohar, on this portion of Emor, says an amazing thing. Kulan Moedin Karinan Lay. All of the festivals we call a Moed, a festival. Nafke Rosh Hashanah v'Yom Kippur, except with the exclusion of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Delo ishtacheach b'hu chedva, because you don't find true joy. True chedva, that's very difficult. I thought Yom Kippur is all about joy. I mean, I wasn't there for the class, but I can't imagine Rabbi Aaron talked about Yom Kippur and didn't mention joy. So what's up with this? As a matter of fact, l'halacha, this is an amazing thing. There's a beautiful, beautiful way that I greet someone on a festival. Okay? In addition, on the main festival, we generally say, Chag Sameach. You should have a happy festival. Right? We don't say Boker Tov, a good day. We say, I wish you, I bless you with happiness. Ah, it's so deep. And when you get to the Chol HaMoed, which is a different level, you say, Moadim L'Simcha. May your times be of joy. What a beautiful greeting. The Halacha, the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, in Tavkuf Bebet, whatever, in the Or Chaim, in the section that deals with this, says, you don't say Moadim L'Simcha on Yom Kippur, on Rosh Hashanah. Because these days aren't about Simcha. They're not about joy. So what is that about? In fact, what do you say? And we're already saying this. You say Ktiva V'Chatima Tova. May you have a good writing and a good sealing. Okay, you get written in the books for everything that's going to happen. Mystically, allegorically, whatever you want to call it, on Rosh Hashanah. But the book doesn't get closed till Yom Kippur. And on Yom Kippur, then the book gets sealed. And after Rosh Hashanah, you don't say, and the tradition is that the tzaddikim, the truly righteous, are written for a good year on Rosh Hashanah, and the truly wicked are written for a bad year, whatever that means. It's all good. A year that's perceived by us to be bad, right? I think you discussed that with the Baron. And the Beinoni, the person who's in the middle, the person who's neither good nor bad, his ceiling, with an S, waits for Yom Kippur. Now, by the way, that's a very interesting question. Because what are the probability that anyone really has exactly as many mitzvot as Avirot? That you're exactly sort of at that point where you're not good nor bad. Or where you maybe have one more mitzvah to go or one more Avirot to go. So that you're somehow in the range of being a Beinoni, of being in the middle. It's ridiculous. There should really be only three or four guys in the world who have to celebrate Yom Kippur. In fact, if you were a betting man, you'd say, you know what? Chances are, either I blew it or I made it. So let's party for the first week of the year. It'd be a great idea. We don't do that. We all get into Yom Kippur. And by the way, I used to think that the concept of a Beinoni was an allegory, was a ridiculous concept until last year's presidential election. And then I discovered that Beinoni really exists. It could really be. If you would have told me that 250 million people would get together and vote, and that the vote would be so close that they had to recount, and that 1,000 people in this country make the difference, that's ridiculous. That's absolutely ridiculous. That's what happened. The Supreme Court had to decide who was the president. It's almost like Hashem decided to appoint the president of the United States. The ruler of the free world today was directly appointed by Hashem. It's an amazing thing. So what is Yom Kippur? It's not about Simcha, right? We say Gemar Tov. You should have a good ceiling. What is that? We sound like a builder's convention. But you know, it's not that simple. Judaism is never that simple, and if it was that simple, I wouldn't have what to talk about, so I'm glad it's not. Because if you look deep into Jewish sources, you find that there are just as many sources that imply the opposite. For example, there's a beautiful Mishnah. It's one of my favorite Mishnayot. It's the last Mishnah in the tractate of Tanit, of fasting. And in this teaching it says, Lo hayu yamim tovim. There were no greater days. Do you know what the two biggest party days in the Jewish calendar are? Two biggest party days. Purim and? Pardon? Simchat Torah. No. Simchat Beis HaShoeva. No. Hanukkah. No. Shavuot. Ooh. Nope. Tu B'Av. The 15th day of Av. Who here celebrated the 15th day of Av this year? Thank you. Not the 15th day of Shvat, Tu B'Shvat, which according to tradition will begin to be celebrated again when the Jewish people come back to the land of Israel. When we get to the period, if you look in the Zohar, when we get to the period preceding redemption, it says the Jewish people will rediscover the festival of Tu B'Shvat, the festival of the trees, because planting trees in America is not the same as planting trees in Israel. And interestingly enough, for the first time in 2,000 years, Jews are celebrating Tu B'Shvat. Come to Israel on the 15th day of Shvat. It's the festival of planting, of trees, of spring, of nature. Only we celebrate it in the middle of the winter. Because we're Jewish. We're a little eh. And it's amazing. You see all these kids in their coats, and they go out and they start planting seedlings. And by the way, it represents a very deep idea. You know, there was a song. I don't remember whose song it was, but Bette Midler sang it. You know, far beneath the bitter snow lies the seed that will become the rose, right? The Tosfot, one of the great commentaries on the Talmud, says that Tu B'Shvat, it's in the tractate of Rosh Hashanah, Tu B'Shvat is the festival that represents the end of Tkufat HaChoref, the end of the winter, the beginning of Tkufat HaKor, the end of the rain, the beginning of the cold. It's the real winter. And we plant trees in the winter because if you're Jewish, you believe that in the middle of the winter, you can plant trees. It's the festival of faith. It's an amazing thing. But nobody celebrates Tu B'Av, 15th day of Av. So the Mishnah says the 15th day of Av, and what's the other big party day? Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur. That's what it says. Look it up. And by the way, do you see how I do that? Yom Kippur. Should we try that again? Yom Kippur. And by the way, just so you understand, although the Mishnah doesn't say this, the Tosefta, the sort of additional Mishnayot, Braitot, that were brought down by Rabbi Chiya, the Tosefta, which is a very important source, explains why they were such great days. It's very difficult. It says because Shehayu Benot Yisrael, the daughters of Israel, would go out to the fields in Kelim Levanim Shulin. They would go out and like borrow, everybody would get into white dresses. It's a beautiful idea. There was no fashion show. You know, some people, some communities, you go to synagogue in Rosh Hashanah, it's a big fashion show. The tradition is that you're supposed to wear white clothing, and you're supposed to actually wear simple white clothing. And imagine if you went to synagogue and everybody was just wearing a simple white dress. It wouldn't be about what you're wearing. It would be about who you are. And so they all used to bother each other's white dresses so the poor wouldn't be embarrassed. They go out to the fields, and it was sort of a Sadie Hawkins day. It was the only day when the girls would ask the boys out. It's amazing. And it says that the girls would look at the guys, and what would the the beautiful girls, what would they say? They would say, Sai necha, teine necha liyofi. Lift up your eyes to the beauty before you, you know? I always think of like the yeshiva boys, you know, that must have made them uncomfortable, you know, it's like, Kippur, they're in the learning, they're learning Rambam. So they bring the Rambam, the Rosh Yeshiva says, you gotta go out to the fields, what the Zev says. So they go out to the fields, but they got their Rambam, and the girl says, okay, just lift up your eyes, give me a break, take it out of the Rambam, okay. And then the Tosefta goes on, it's a great Tosefta. It says, what about the girls, Nebuch, they weren't so pretty. What did they say? Tene necha l'mishpacha. I may not be so pretty, but, you know, I got great yichus. I'm the granddaughter of the Vilna Gaon. I have a family tree you wouldn't believe. And the Tosefta goes on and says, Nebuch, what would the girls say if they weren't so beautiful? And they didn't have a big yichus, a big family tree. I love this. They would say, no, do a mitzvah. I love it. Right? And, you know, they quote George Bernard Shaw. They quote George Bernard Shaw as having said, if you want to do a real mitzvah, whistle at a homely girl. It's a good chop, right? Okay. What you do with that is up to you. I think it's a mitzvah. You don't have to. I don't see any homely girls, but okay. So this is Yom Kippur? This is Yom Kippur? In fact, this is so difficult for some of the commentaries that some of them say this must be an allegory. It can't really be talking about Yom Kippur. There was one opinion that Tiferet Yisrael, I got it already. I got the Tiferet Yisrael. Oh, you're deep. You're holy. The Tiferet Yisrael. Right? The Tiferet Yisrael goes so far as to say it can't be real. It must be an allegory. Some of the commentaries say maybe this isn't talking really about Yom Kippur. It's only a message on Yom Kippur, but it's really talking about the 15th day of Av. But that's not really the contextual, straightforward understanding. It's not pshat. In fact, in the Mishnah, Shlomo HaMelech says, King Solomon says, "Biyom chatun nati, biyom simchat libi." This is the day of the joy of my heart. And we know from the Book of Kings that Yom Kippur actually is the day that the first temple was dedicated. It's an amazing thing. They dedicate the first Beit HaMikdash, one of the greatest moments in Jewish history. And the whole description about the singing and the dance and the song, it was all on Yom Kippur. So it's a day of joy. And by the way, what happened on Yom Kippur? Just so you understand why it should be a day of joy. On the 6th, 7th day of Sivan, Hashem speaks to us at Sinai. 40 days later, the month after Sivan, the 4th month, Tammuz, on the 17th day of Tammuz, Moses is on his way down, and something's off. And what is going on at the bottom of the mountain while Moshe is up there learning Torah with God? The golden calf. It doesn't get much worse. So Moshe breaks the tablets. It's an incredibly intense moment. Very intense. There's a very deep message there. It's interesting. Moshe doesn't say much. He breaks the tablets. And then he goes back up the mountain for another 40 days to talk to God. Now, by the way, that's an interesting thing. Because where should Moshe be? He should be talking to the Jewish people. Why is he spending 40 days up with God? He should spend another 40 days with the Jews. And there are many different ideas. He's trying to lobby. It's strange. What do you mean I have to lobby God? I'm not going to get into this issue, but it's a very difficult question. You can't lobby God from down below? If you can't find God amidst the Jewish people, what are you looking up on the mountain? There is one opinion which seems to come from the Sfat Emet, if I'm understanding it correctly, that Moshe was arguing with himself. He was in a state of so much pain and so much anger, he knew he couldn't teach. That's a very deep idea. I was just talking to somebody about this. You can't teach out of anger. Can't teach out of anger. Can't communicate out of anger. If you're ever angry at someone you love, you want to know the best piece of advice? Don't speak. Just don't speak. Imagine how much pain would be spared the world if we never spoke when we were angry. How many silly things do we say when we're angry? That doesn't mean you never show your children, for example, that you're angry. But you know, when I get really angry at my kids, I tell them, I can't talk to you now, I'm too angry. I wait till I'm not angry, and then I come back and I pretend I'm angry. Because they need to think you're angry. But you can't teach them if you're really angry. So Moshe goes up for 40 days, he prays, he gets forgiveness, he comes down. And he tells Jewish people, okay, but there's a catch. Hashem says to Moshe, okay, nice job, but I think you're forgetting something. I gave you this pair of tablets, it was a pretty important piece of art. You broke them. Now you have to fashion two tablets like the ones you broke. Now, that's a simple line. People gloss over it. Can you imagine what it must feel like for Moshe to hear from God? You broke, you fix. That must be very difficult. And by the way, what's he trying to fix? The Luchot HaBrit. So Moshe goes up and he has to do it all over again. And 40 days later, now remember, 7th of Sivan, 40 days later is the 17th of Tammuz. 40 days later, there are 3 days in the middle, actually two. The month of Tammuz is 29 days. Moshe comes down one day, goes up a day. 40 days later is the 10th day of Tishrei. The third 40-day period ends on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is the day that Moshe comes down with the second tablets. Only these tablets, they didn't come from God. They came from partnership. They came from us. That's why Yom Kippur is that moment of forgiveness. So can you imagine what it must have felt like for the Jewish people to know that they were forgiven? What a moment of joy. What a moment of pure, raw, unadulterated singing. And that's Yom Kippur. And that makes a lot of sense. So Yom Kippur should be a day of joy. And I'll give you an even better example. There's an amazing story in the book of Nehemiah. It's a good story because most people don't get to Nehemiah. It's over at the end of the Bible. So. And it's such a lesson for us. The second temple. We look at the temple, the Beit HaMikdash, through rose-colored glasses. It wasn't so simple. The first temple, the first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. The Jews went into exile for 70 years in Babylon. If you want to understand what that means, look at communist Russia. The communist revolution was in 1917. Okay? It took 70 years for the Iron Curtain to fall. And look at the desolation and the desecration of Judaism that occurred in Russia for 70 years. How many yeshivot were destroyed? How many millions of Jews were killed in the time of Stalin? How much religion was lost? How much Torah was lost? How many Jews in Russia, coming from Russia, and families are so lost? So the Jews were in Babylon for 70 years. You don't go to Babylon after having a temple and after having the temple destroyed, which itself came from a space that wasn't so good. It wasn't like the Jews were in, you know, yeshiva to begin with. So by the time they come back up to build the second temple, things are not so great. Most of the Jews are in Babel. Ezra, who becomes the exilarch in Israel, does not actually come up to help with the building of the second temple. He stays in Babel. Now, don't get me wrong. The reason he stays in Babel in Babylon is because he's learning Torah with a fellow by the name of Baruch ben Neriah. And Baruch ben Neriah is the student par excellence of Yirmiyahu, of Jeremiah the prophet. Baruch ben Neriah learned Torah from Yirmiyahu, from Jeremiah, at the end of the period of the first temple. So don't get me wrong. If you could learn Torah in New York City from the student of Yirmiyahu, that would be a good reason to be in New York. But when Baruch ben Neriah dies, so Ezra decides he's going home. And he makes a call to everybody to come. And nobody wants to come. Because of the powers that he's given by Cyrus, Koresh, because he's the governor, because he carries weight, he gets 50,000 Jews to come up to Babylon with him, to come up to Israel. Many historians suggest that as many as 4 million, minimally 2 million Jews. Millions of Jews are in Babylon, and they never make it to Israel. At the most, there are 120,000 Jews in Israel, in a very small area around Jerusalem. And by the way, just as an aside, just so we understand, we're not talking about ancient history. What happens to those 4 million Jews in Babel? They completely disappear. By the time the second temple is destroyed a few hundred years later, there's nothing left of them. Now, we have no record of any major persecution in Babel during that time. They just assimilate. They become Babylonians. It's exactly what we're experiencing. When I grew up, the number that was thrown around was 6 million Jews. They used to say there were 6 million Jews in America. Then they said there were 5.5. And they said 5. The number that's being thrown around now is 4.5, 4.6 million Jews. And by the way, that number is from a U.S. Census. And that U.S. Census includes anyone who defines themselves as Jewish. How many of those Jews are Jewish? And what that Judaism means? And what percentage of their children? You know, there are 1.7 million mixed marriages in America today. 1.7 million Jews are married to non-Jewish partners. And 9 out of 10 of the children of those 1.7 million Jews do not define themselves as Jews and have no interest in being defined as Jews. And if you translate that, that means there will be less than 100,000 Jews in America in about 35 years. That's mind-boggling. And there's no Adolf Hitler. They're just disappearing into the night. So Ezra gets up to the land of Israel, and what he finds there breaks his heart. The Kohanim are marrying non-Jews. Don't think this is a new problem. People don't know what Shabbat is. They don't know what Kashrut is. They've forgotten the Torah of their forefathers. So he calls them all together. Most of them don't want to come. They have no interest in coming. And he forces them. He has certain legal authority. Anybody that doesn't come to the temple for Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, their land will be forfeit. This is by order of the king. They all come. And then, it's not clear what he does. But whatever he does must have been very powerful. And it says, Vayasfu Kolam, this is in the 8th chapter of Nehemiah, the whole people gather, Ki'ishachad, like one people. Vayomru le'Ezra Sofer, so the Kohanim tell Ezra, bring the Sefer Torah Moshe, bring the Torah. And Ezra brings the Torah. Vayom Echad l'Chodesh Hashvi, on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. On Rosh Hashanah. Vayikravo, and he begins to read the verses. Vayamod al Migdal Eitz, Ezra Sofer stands on a tall tower.
and he begins to read the psukim, the verses. Vayivarech Ezra et Hashem Elohim Agadol, and he blesses God for this moment. And the Jewish people, they begin to hear, and they begin to tremble, and they begin to cry, and they throw themselves on the ground. Oy me'elanu, look where we are, and yet look where we are. And somehow Ezra, and it's interesting, Ezra affected a mass tshuva movement in one day. It's okay, let it out, it's okay. I was a giggler, I was a big giggler once. He doesn't do it by yelling Shabbos. He doesn't do it by throwing stones. He doesn't do it by passing pork laws in the Knesset. He just reads from the Torah, so deep. And then he talks to them about Yom Kippur, and listen to this line. He says, Hayom Kadoshu, this day is coming, Yom Kippur, and it's holy. L'Hashem Elokechem. Now listen to this. Al tit ablu. Don't mourn. Ve'al tifku, and don't cry. Ki bochim kol ha'am. Kishom ha'am et ivrei ha'Torah. Because the people are crying when they hear the Torah. Vayom alahem lechu, ichlu, mishmanim, ushtu mamtakim. Eat, drink, be merry, al tiatzvu. Ki chedvat Hashem imauschem, because the joy of God is your strength. And he goes on, Yom Kippur. And it seems like we're supposed to be happy. So which is it? And I want you to know there are many, many sources. And there's no end. What is Yom Kippur supposed to be? Is it supposed to be a day of joy? Is it supposed to be a day of sadness? So I want to share with you an idea. Hashem should bless us that we carry this idea into Yom Kippur. There are so many Jews who need this idea. I can't begin to tell you. What do you do when you have different sources and they imply different things? What do you do? How do you know the answer? So it's really very simple. The first place you look is the halacha, Jewish tradition. What does halacha tell me? Does Jewish tradition tell me it's a day of joy or a day of sadness? And there's actually one way that you can determine very easily whether technically Yom Kippur is a day of joy or a day of sadness. It's very easy. There's a halacha, which is a very difficult halacha. About 6 years ago, 5 years ago, you may remember, this is the last time the Arabs thought they were going to solve something with violence. When the Kotel tunnel was opened, or the little portion of the Kotel tunnel that had been added on was opened, so the Arabs started riots, they claimed we were taking over the temple now, and all sorts of narishkeit. It was terrible. It was 3 years after the Oslo Accords. It was a year and a half after we had given away Aza and Hebron, establishment of a Palestinian authority, Palestinian policemen. It was a watershed event for the Israeli army. And I remember the implications and the briefings and the new plans we had to come up with, because this was the first instance that Palestinian policemen, using Israeli guns that we had given them, and I'm not getting into the politics, opened fire on Israeli soldiers. We armed them, and they opened fire. And for 3 very intense days of rioting, many, many Jews were in very difficult situations. There were 11 Israeli soldiers that were killed. One of them was a boy by the name of Amikam, who I got to know because he was a very good friend of Yoni Riskin, friend of mine, son of Rav Riskin, one of my rabbeim. And the funeral, this all happened, not at all accidentally, right around the period of Yom Kippur, just like last year, Rosh Hashanah. And the funeral for Amikam was on the eve of the festival of Sukkot. Now in Israel, on the eve of the festival, most people don't go to work. It's like Sunday, Erev Chag. So the funeral was in Efrat, where I live, and many people knew Amikam. And the whole city turned out for the funeral. Must have been 5,000-6,000 people. And Riskin, who's a Kohen, gave the Hesped, the eulogy, outside, so that he wouldn't be in the synagogue with the body. Kohen doesn't come into contact with a dead body. And it was one of the most painful, powerful eulogies I recall. And from there, we went to the Beit Kvarot, to the cemetery. And by the time we finished burying Amikam, it was about an hour and a half, 2 hours before the festival. So we went from the cemetery home to shower, to get dressed in our Yom Tov finery, and to go to shul. and to begin the festival of Sukkot, concerning which the Torah teaches us there is actually a mitzvah to rejoice. V'samachta b'chagecha, which is said in reference to Sukkot, to this festival, and you shall be of joy on your festival. That, by the way, is also a very difficult question. How can you have a mitzvah to be happy? Right? Happiness is a psychological state. You are happy or you're not happy. So we'll get to that in a minute. But in fact, you have the ability to decide you're going to be happy. Make no mistake about it. Don't think there are things in my life and therefore I'm depressed. If things were better, I wouldn't be depressed. That's not true. The things in your life have nothing to do with whether you're happy or depressed. You are completely the master of your state of mind. And if you decide that you're going to be happy, then you will be happy, whatever happens. And if you decide never, you're going to be depressed, you'll be depressed, whatever happens. We all know people like that. But the most amazing thing, such a difficult halacha, is that the family of Amikam went home, sat Shiva, right? You know there's a Shiva in Judaism, an amazing system. When you lose a loved one that close, you don't ignore the pain. You don't do a wake, joke around, try to distract the mourner from his pain, and then go back to life the next day. You're supposed to wallow in it, focus in it, deal with it, confront it. And only 7 days later, and during those 7 days, you sit on the floor, and you don't eat meat, and you don't drink wine, and you're not even supposed to learn Torah. Because it might bring you some joy. Let it out. Deal with it. And only 7 days later do you begin the process of re-entering life. Because you have to respect that kind of contact with death. But if during your Shiva there's a festival, the festival breaks the Shiva. And you get up, and you go to synagogue, and you don't sit back down afterwards. You're finished. Can you imagine? How do you deal with that? Now don't get me wrong. This is an incredible halacha. And just to clue you in on what that halacha is, Rav Soloveitchik talks about this. You see, the pain of a Shiva is my individual pain. There are two concepts within the Jewish people. There is Reb Yisrael, the individual Jew, and there is Am Yisrael, the Jewish people. And my pain of Shiva is my pain. But the joy of a festival, that's not just my joy. That's the joy of the entire Jewish people. And so I put aside the pain of Reb Yisrael, the individual, and I link with the joy of the entire Jewish people. Am Yisrael. That's a very powerful idea. Because if I can feel pain as an individual, when I'm surrounded by the joy of the Jewish people, I'm missing something. So I don't say it's easy, it's a very difficult halacha. So then the question is, okay, so what happens on Yom Kippur? If on Yom Kippur it breaks the Shiva, that tells me it's a festival. It's a day of joy. And if Yom Kippur does not break the Shiva, for example, like Shabbat, on Shabbat you don't publicly mourn, but you do privately mourn on certain levels, and you sit back down to Shiva after Shabbat, because Shabbat is not a day of joy, it's a day of pleasure, it's different. There's a side to Shabbat which is about the individual. So if Yom Kippur is not a day of joy, then it doesn't break the Shiva. And of course the halacha is that Yom Kippur breaks the Shiva. So Yom Kippur is a day of joy. So how do you deal with this? So I wish we had an hour and a half. But in a few minutes remaining, I'll give you an idea. Listen to this idea. What you do with it is up to you. What does it mean? Ve'initem et nafshotechem, and you shall cause your souls to be afflicted. You see, the truth is, there are two meanings to the word inui. There's another meaning. When Moshe is on the mountain, and he comes down, because God tells him, Lechret kishichetamcha, go down, your people have become destructive. Moshe isn't quite sure, at least according to the context, of what he's getting himself into. And he runs into Yeshua halfway down the mountain. And Yeshua, relieved to see Moshe, says, Kol milchama, I hear a voice of war from the camp. And Moshe responds, Lo kol chalusha, it's not a sound of defeat. Velo kol gvurah, it's not a sound of victory, which would be war. Kol anot, anishomea. I hear a sound of anot. Inui, anot. Now what does anot mean? La anot is to respond, it's the answer. It's a sound which is a response to a stimulus. And the sound I'm hearing is a sound which isn't quite definable because it depends what the stimulus is. What do I mean by this? You know, we blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. And the sounds of the shofar are described by the Gemara, by the Talmud, as Yelile Yalil V'Genuche Ganach. The sounds of the sobbing and the sighing. And it's an amazing thing where we learn these sounds from. Does anybody know where we learn the sounds from? We learn these sounds from the mother of Sisera. Sisera was a general trying to destroy the Jewish people and was eventually vanquished by Yael, and he didn't come home. And the whole story, by the way, the prophetess, Devorah, it's all about women. That's another discussion. And at the end of that story, the Navi, the prophets, take us to the palace of Sisera, the Canaanite palace. And the mother of Sisera is sitting by her window, waiting for her son to come home. Even a Sisera has a mother. Adolf Hitler had a mother. Everybody has a mother. And Sisera's mother is waiting by the window for her son to come home, like he always does, from the victory. And she begins to see the soldiers coming back, bedraggled. And she begins to understand that Sisera isn't coming home. And first she begins to sigh and to sob. And then huge heaving sobs. And I never understood what these sounds were until once at a funeral. I made a terrible mistake. My parents were in Israel. I was supposed to be on leave. Longer story, but a soldier in my unit got killed. And I went to the funeral, and my parents, who had planned on having a day with me, decided they didn't want me to go on my own. They wanted to go with me. And I very silly agreed, because they had a car and they could drive me. And it was a big mistake. You shouldn't let your mother go to an army funeral when you're still in the army. Big mistake. But we went, and it was a Sephardic funeral. Rav Mizrahi, Alav Shalom, Shem Yikom Damo. And the Sephardim, they're very different than the Ashkenazim. The Ashkenazim Western Jews, we're very proper. You know, we can't cry. It's a Western thing, don't cry. It's the most ridiculous thing. Judaism teaches that crying is good for the soul. Tears clean your soul. They don't go down, they go up. So if you have an urge to cry, you should cry. When you cry, it means that you're encountering something real. It's good. The Sephardim, they have no such compunctions. They let it all hang out. So you go to a Sephardic funeral, unfortunately, screaming and sobbing. And they make this terrible sound. You know, it sounds something like, "Oh!" It's horrible. It's horrible. And the woman is like screaming, "Ah! Don't leave me. I'm not ready for you to go." And she's throwing herself on the... It's terrible. And that funeral still sticks with me. And he was an amazing guy. And a few months later, I was actually at a bar mitzvah at a kotel. At the kotel. And there was a Sephardic bar mitzvah. And it suddenly hit me, they were making the same sound. You ever go to the kotel or a Sephardic bar mitzvah? That's what they do. That's what they do. It's the same sound. It's the same sound. The same yalil yalil. And we know this. People cry from pain and people cry from joy. The line is that thin. And I'll give you a great example. Rav Riskin once told me a story. There's a great rabbi, his name is Rav Grossman. He's an amazing fellow. He has a yeshiva for ex-cons. It's an amazing idea, right? Hard to find donors, but it's an amazing idea. And so he used to come to New York to get help, and he would stay with a Riskin. And one Shabbos, he came to New York, and he's like a chashuv yid, a rav with the whole getup, the beard, and the shtreimel, and the bekasher. And a Riskin, you know, my shaver has disappeared. Somebody's going to lend me one for Shabbos, I hope. But, you know, he's like clean-shaven, you know, wears a suit. So Rav Grossman, at the end of, like, Friday night dinner, said, "Let's go for a walk." Right? So I said, "Okay, let's go for a walk." He's a guest. So they go for a walk. And he says, "Let's walk up there on Broadway." So Riskin, you know, he used to have a custom not to walk down Broadway, New York City, on Shabbos. You know, a little Shabbos environment. So Riskin said, "Maybe we'll walk here. It's quieter. It's so noisy there. Bar Shabbos." So Rav Grossman says, "Well, aren't there a lot of Jews who go to these places?" So Riskin said, "Yeah, okay, so let's go there." So they go. So Riskin thought it was a little weird, but okay. So they walk along Broadway, and they pass by a bar, a disco. This is in the disco days. And the disco had like a glass window, and through the disco you could see all these Jews, you know, boogie. And here's Rav Grossman and Riskin and the Shabbos, and they're outside. And Rav Grossman says, "What's going on in there?" So Riskin says, "Oh, it's a disco." And Rav Grossman looks back, right? And he sees it's called Jerusalem Disco. So Rav Grossman says, "Jerusalem Disco? What do you mean?" So Rav Riskin says, "Yeah, actually, the disco is owned by an Israeli. Nebuch, it's the only disco that I couldn't get to close down on Yom Kippur. There's a lot of Jews on the west side. Rav Riskin had a deal. They would close their bars on Yom Kippur so Jews wouldn't go there, you know, whatever. A little shifty, right? But this disco was owned by an Israeli, so they didn't do it." Okay, typical, fine. So Rav Grossman said, "Really?" He says, "There must be a lot of Jews in there." Rav Riskin says, "Yeah, Nebuch." So Rav Riskin says, "Great, let's go inside." Rav Riskin's like, "You know, it's Friday night. You know, you know, disco Friday night. They're all dancing. What do you mean, go inside?" Rav Grossman says, "You don't understand." He says, "Look through this glass. You know what it's like? It's like a fly in a bottle. You see a fly in a bottle. It looks like it's dancing. But it's really gasping for air. You think these people are dancing? They're gasping for air. Let's go give them some air. So, is your guest? Can't say no. So they walk into the disco. Now, Rav Grossman, he looks like a Rav Grossman. But Rav Riskin, you know, he's like me, you know, a little suit, whatever. So Rav Riskin's like a little embarrassed. People see him. The congregator walk by on Broadway. What's Rav Riskin doing in the disco? He was a little jealous. He wished he had a Becker shirt, because then it would be clear he wasn't going in for that. But okay. It happened to be that one of the band members playing used to come to Rabbi Riskin's Wednesday night lectures. He was like sort of getting involved. And he looks across. You can't miss a Rav Grossman walking into a disco on a Friday night. He sees this Rav, and then he sees Rabbi Riskin. He's like terribly embarrassed. So he stops drumming. So the guitarist sees the drummer stop drumming, turns around, sees the rabbi, he stops playing. All of a sudden, the band stops playing. The band stops playing. People stop dancing. Everybody's looking around, there's a rabbi. So Rav Grossman, who doesn't speak that much English, looks at Rav Riskin. He says, look, I don't speak any English. Go ahead, say something. So what do you do? So Rav Riskin, you know, he got up, he spoke, gave it to our Torah, they started some separate circles. No! It only lasted an hour. I'm sure when they left, the disco went on. But okay, Baruch Hashem. Sometimes you see people crying. Sometimes you see people crying, they're really laughing. Sometimes you see people laughing, and they're really crying. You know? The line is that thin. And the language of Inui can mean pain, it can mean song. For example, in the 25th chapter of Dvarim, when you bring Bikurim, the first fruit, you know what it says? It says you go up to the temple with your first fruit, beginnings, a moment of pure, raw appreciation. And it says, Ve'anita ve'amarta. What does Ve'anita there mean? And you shall sing. La'anot means to sing. On the night of Passover, we eat matzah. What's matzah called? It's called Lechem Oni. Now, Lechem Oni can be bread of affliction. It's also called in the Talmud, Lechem She'onim Alav Halel. The bread over which you sing Halel. La'anot also means to sing. And it's so interesting, because you see, one person's singing is another person's crying. One person's pain is another person's joy. Because it's all about perspective. Just like we started over there. And what is Yom Kippur? You see, Rosh Hashanah is a big question mark. Rosh Hashanah is the day we were born. It's the day it all began. It's a moment of pure potential. Beginnings. Don't think it's accidental that the war that we're in, and don't, by the way, I've heard people call it the events, intifada, the occurrences in Israel. It's a war. What's the definition of a war? You have an enemy, they have guns, and they're trying to kill you. It fits. It's a war. And it's not accidental that this latest outbreak of the war started on Rosh Hashanah. Don't think that's an accident. Because it's a new stage. We're beginning something, whatever it is. And as much as it's difficult, and as much as it's painful, and as much as we should feel that pain, from all these things, good will come. What do you think? You think we lasted 2,000 years so that the United Nations could send observers and send us back to New York? Give me a break. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying we know what we're entering. But if it comes from Hashem, it has to be good. Nebuchadnezzar, if nothing comes from Hashem, then nothing is good. And nothing is bad. You know what's much worse than bad? Random. That's terribly depressing. To be random. To be alone. So Rosh Hashanah is a big question mark. And the books get opened, and I don't know. But Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, and this will end. Yom Kippur is the day where it all makes sense. Why do I not eat and drink and do all these things? All these things are the world of the physical. And Judaism says, you should not deny yourself from the physical. That's not what Judaism teaches. It's not about monasticism. But one day a year, let go of the physical. And you know why you let go of the physical? And this is something I understand from the Sfas Emes, if I'm getting it right. You know, it's interesting. You'll hear people say, there's a famous line from Yisrael Salanter on Tisha B'Av, the anniversary of the destruction of the temple, I fast because you're so sad, how could you eat? And on Yom Kippur I fast because I'm so happy, I don't need to eat. Right? We're like the angels. We don't need to eat. That's all very nice and good. But I'll give you a little clue. The guy who prays the evening service at the end of Yom Kippur, you know, when you finish the whole day, and the Shachris, and the Musaf, and the Ni'ilah, and everything, and then you have like one little prayer left, the evening service. Now, if a guy went up to the evening service, And he started being like the Chazan of Musaf. They'd kill him. They'd stone him. And everybody in the room at the end of Neilah is thinking one thing. It's very holy. It's very holy. Bagels. Because that's who we are. And that's okay. And the joy of Yom Kippur is that even though I love to eat, and even though I can elevate my soul when I eat, the eve of Yom Kippur, I actually eat for God, which I love to do. Just like on Yom Kippur, I fast for God. It's precisely because I'm hungry on Yom Kippur. It's precisely because I discover that one day a year, I make a statement that the physical side of me, that my desires don't rule me, I rule them. That's an enormous level of joy. One day a year, I discover that Hashem loves me so much that I'm forgiven, no matter what I did. That I can start all over again. Do you ever wonder why we sing the vidui? You know, there's a song, right? Avinu Malkeinu. Avinu Malkeinu, Chaneinu Vaneinu, Ki Ein Banu Masi. It's an amazing song. Do you know what the words mean? Okay, think about this. Our Father, our King, please have mercy on us, because we have nothing. That's what we're singing? Hey, we have no mitzvos. We are losers. Let's sing about it. That's ridiculous. And then we do this like, you know, Ashamnu, Bogadnu, we have betrayed, we have stolen, we have slandered, we are terrible, we are disgusting. Let's party about it. That's ridiculous. But you see, it's precisely because we recognize what we've done. And we realize that Hashem forgives us. And we recognize we can start all over again. That we experience such a high level of joy. You know what V'initim et nafshotechem means? One day a year, you shall cause your souls to sing. And that is so deep. And Hashem should bless us this year, when we so need it. You know, one of the beautiful things about singing, and we're going to do this tonight around the campfire. I'm so excited. When you sing together, and it's a big group, you think like, okay, what's one person, that person? You know, we're going to get to Shabbos. There's nothing higher than Shabbos. And you can't get as high here as you can in Israel. But I promise you, that another day, that the 24 hours of Shabbat, that you are in the holiest place in America. That I can guarantee you. It's not going to get any higher. And one of the ways we get so high, we don't need other things to get high. We get high on singing. You know? And when you're singing on a Friday night, there's always someone, not God forbid in a negative way, who has something important to share, he's talking to somebody, and he doesn't realize that if a whole group is singing, we don't get high just because we sing. We get high because we sing together. If one person in a corner of the room is talking and not singing, then everybody's missing something. And it's not about you shouldn't talk because it's not nice to the people who are singing. It's we love each other so much, and we can find such joy in being together that there's a little piece of pain if somebody isn't there. It's an awesome experience. You don't know when you'll get a chance to do that again. So grab onto that ride. Hashem should bless us this year through Rosh Hashanah and the 10 days of Tshuva and Yom Kippur. But this year, for us, for the Jewish people, and especially for the Jewish people in the land of Israel, that this year, finally, we all get to sing.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.